Welcome to Tales from the Waystone, a Kingkiller Chronicle reread podcast.
We are your hosts, Will and Phoenix. Let's get into it.
Welcome to Tales from the Waystone, Season 2, Episode 57, Quoth Brought His Pencil, where we will be looking at Chapters 116 and 117 of The Wise Man's Fear through the lens of interrogating taboos.
Such a lovely, lovely title for this episode.
I mean, okay, we're just going to get it out of the way here. Yeah, there's no way you can't think of Van Halen's Hot for Teacher in this one.
Ew. All right. Ew.
Vachette brought him something to write on.
Did you say write or ride?
Right.
Okay. Before we get too far down this rabbit hole, now you know the tone. Brief explanation of the pod. Each week, we will be examining a section of The Wise Man's Fear through a chosen lens and figuring out what we can take from the text and apply to our real lives. We will also take some time to focus on a phronemos of the week. Guess who went in and changed the dock? AKA a character that exemplifies some aspect of practical wisdom that we would like to learn from or emulate. Then we will share a recommended thing of the week and finally wrap things up with seven words from the book and seven words from our own lives. Let's also get some disclaimers out of the way. First of all, we are in no way affiliated with Patrick Rothfuss or his publisher, Daw Books. And there will be spoilers. And in this episode, there will be both silly and frank conversations about sex. Also, a word to our community. Please be kind to yourselves, one another, and the creators of the worlds that we love exploring.
All right, so let's start in with chapter 116, Height. There's not a lot to this chapter. It's basically the entire plot of Hot for Teacher. But
okay, I do actually want to discuss this. In case you're new here, I am asexual. I'm not like repulsed. I'm kind of indifferent. I'm very curious about it as a other people seem to enjoy this academic kind of way of being curious about it. I do watch a YouTube channel called Sexplanations. I like watching kind of sciencey, academic, whatever's about things. Like, I don't like this, so you can't either. I'm more about things, but you do you, man. Or you do other people, you know. I'm happy when other people are excited to have sex with one another. I just am not one of those people, and I'd prefer it that way. And so I also have a very kind of academic, analytical view of this rather than it being ew, ew, go away, ew, or oh, well, that's hot. I have more of a interesting, our taboos around sex and especially power dynamics within that are curiosities to me, kind of. There's something that I wonder about and think about, but have no desire to partake in.
So looking at it, you have to think about, okay, what are the quote, Aturan taboos, which are really typical American taboos around these sorts of things? And why do they exist? And then what is it that makes the Adem society different? Is any of this even remotely realistic? Or is this just an excuse to indulge in some fantasies?
That's the other part about this is like, is this all just Pat being kind of icky?
I'm not going to rule that out because you know what? It's okay for authors to be a little icky from time to time.
Or is this more wish fulfillment? Is this more exploring taboos? But then did he go further and then the publisher or the editor or anybody kind of rein him back? I don't think we'll ever know the answer to that one. But I'm wondering if there is kind of this meta-textual look at this that we could go into also. Because essentially what happens is teenage boy is sparring with 20-something-year-old teacher. So even though they try to make it sound like it's a vast difference in age, I think I'm 41-year-old person. If I dated someone who was 51 or if I dated someone who was 31, it really wouldn't be such a vast, gross ick that we get when we are talking about someone who is, Quoth is 16.
Yeah, she's 26. There's a lot that happens in between those ages.
There is, but also at the same time, like, I don't like the implication here that Kvothe is looking at her as though she's old.
I mean, I've been in an age differential relationship before. And yeah, I was 27. She was 38. Wasn't that big a deal. Had it been going the other direction, yeah, that would have been a whole different story.
What do you mean? Like if you were 38?
No.
Oh, if you were 27 and they were like, I'm not going to say underage, so I'm going to say 18.
Yeah, that's exactly what I mean.
That'll be a little weird.
Yeah.
But I think you would feel a little weird.
Yes.
Not everyone feels a little weird.
No. It's also worth noting that norms of adulthood are also very societal. So we consider 18 to be the age of majority because that's when most kids move out of the house.
Not anymore.
Well, they nominally can move out of the house. Let's put it this way.
It's more along the lines of they can vote.
Or they might go to college or...
Yeah, high school's done around that time.
That said, in Kvothe's position, he's been living on his own.
Right. So I'm not taking this as completely icky. I do, though, think it's a little wish fulfillment-y. I mean, he's had his experience with Florian.
I mean, if we're going to talk about age difference.
Yeah. Enough said. He's had his fling with Losi, not sure what. But it's not like he's completely not practiced at anything. He's just, his sample size is 2, and one of them is a goddess.
So there's that.
So we've got someone who he finds physically attractive, who is the only person that is deigning to speak with him, really, in this whole society, and who is being friendly and kind and is also like his one tether to humanity at this moment. And I can't speak to being a teenage boy, but maybe you can.
Any port in a storm is a thing.
And so anecdotally, I can look at that and go, there's a reason that what we have to infer, because it's not clearly spelled out, but it's clearly enough spelled out, Kvothe is aroused. And I have to say, I really appreciate that Vachette's attitude is, you gonna take care of that by yourself or do you need a partner?
Well, and part of it also is that the society that they're in does not have all of the romantic baggage surrounding sexuality that we do.
Or that the Aeturin do.
So as far as they're concerned, sex and romance and family are all completely separate concepts.
Honestly, actually, that's pretty much me too. So in case you are unfamiliar, LGBTQIA, the A is aspec, which is asexual, agender, aromantic, and I'm two of those. I'm agender and asexual, meaning I really don't have like a sexual attraction to people, but I do have a romantic attraction. Otherwise, we would not have been, we've been married for nearly 12 years. So there's at least something there.
Yeah.
So attractions can be on multiple types of axes. There can be aesthetic attraction where you find someone to be hot or visually appealing or what have you, cute, whatever words you want to use to state that you find someone aesthetically attractive or aesthetically, yeah, attractive. I find you aesthetically attractive.
Well, that's good to know.
And then there's like romantically attractive, which I do find you romantically attractive. I just don't find anyone sexually attractive. It's not personal. It's just not a thing. It's not, I don't know. It's just like that's kind of deleted out of my being. But there's like, you know, sensual attraction doesn't have to be related to sexual attraction, doesn't have to be related to romantic attraction. And I feel a bit like the Adem have been portrayed as though they are aromantic.
Or at least that sex and romance have nothing to do with each other.
Right. They are different graphs. They are different axes. But also it might be that they're more like demi-romantic, where you have to have formed a strong bond with someone before there is a romance aspect.
I think there may be some of that. But I mean, the important thing is because sexuality doesn't really have any connotations in that regard, it doesn't have any emotional ties or anything. It's something that is less subject to power imbalance, at least theoretically.
Right. In this particular case, Vachette is like, you're not going to concentrate on anything other than sex until you have had it. Let's go.
Yeah, I mean, it's not like she's just doing this dutifully or anything. She seems to be enjoying herself well enough.
Actually, she seems to want sex, partner agnostic.
Yeah. And, well, Kvothe is available.
And aroused. So, all of this being said, Kvothe, who went through an entire chunk of this book becoming sexually liberated, has gotten back into repressed times where he can't be open and honest. And I think that might actually be like framing device Kvothe is going, I really can't describe this the way that I would like to describe this because social mores, even though one of you is Faye and the other one of you is a writer, I have to be delicate.
It's one thing to experience and enjoy something privately, and it's also something completely different to discuss it with other people, especially in front of someone who's writing it all down.
Okay, but he described all of Florian.
Yeah, there was that too.
Already, ostensibly, today.
Yes.
Something that we have been doing for 3 years, today. Like this, this whole book, one day. Different discussion. But essentially, he's just like, I would never, ever, ever in my life, ever, 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 ever in my, no, existence, like, I am so embarrassed, damn it, go away, like, kind of talking to his penis. But I would never want to have sex with any of my other teachers. All your other teachers are dudes if you're not homosexual in any way, bi, pan, any of that. If you only like women.
Well, the university is kind of a sausage festival.
Right, but if he's not into that, which there's nothing wrong with being het. Seriously, of course he's not going to go like
Fork.
Skeleton.
There's also, I'd say, a very different power differential between the masters at the university versus his relationship with Vachette. Vachette is a close mentor. Like, she is someone that he has a very close one-on-one relationship with.
And it's not really academic so much as it's, there is a physical imbalance here, so she is more physically powerful, and he knows that. And to a point, it is played off as though, even though women can be stronger than men, and in this case, Vachette is stronger than Kvothe, this society, the one we are currently living in, does not view an older woman with a younger man to be predatory in the way that an older man with a younger woman would be.
Typically, although in scenarios where there is a teacher-student relationship, that power imbalance, though, can be pretty...
It's gross.
Yeah.
But we still kind of look at it and go, she's got to be mentally ill, not she has a power fantasy.
Right.
However, also in this particular instance, I'm not going to discount the idea of, like, an older male mentor and a younger male student having an absolutely just bonkers wrong, like, power dynamic in this space either. I'm not ignoring the fact that no matter what your gender is, and I'm picking male and female because the majority of people are, but this one is not played as predatory. It's played very much matter of fact. And I would say that the Florian stuff is way more predatory. This is just to the point.
It never feels like this is a situation where Kvothe is being manipulated into these scenarios.
Nor is Vachette.
Like, they're both just taking care of business and then moving on.
And even, like, Kvothe wants to show Vachette a good time, a la the way that Florian taught him to, which is great, except she doesn't care.
She's taking care of herself. She knows what she wants.
She's like, you are a tool. I'm going to use you. Let's go do it. I am also a tool. You use me. We're good.
It's a, you scratch my back, I'll scratch yours.
It's kind of a mechanical thing, but in the same, like, you can still take pleasure in doing things that are mechanical. goal-ish. That's kind of the wrong way. You can take pleasure in doing things that are necessary.
Yeah. Having a meal, for instance.
You could either have a joyless 10-cent ramen at your desk while you're working lunch, or you could, if you have the funds for it, go to a lovely steak restaurant with all of the fixings and all of the great, wonderful things that make you all happy and have everything just be unctuous and beautiful and take 4 hours and 17 courses and whatever.
That usually doesn't happen at work. But I take your point. You can have a meal with someone without it being necessarily a preferential thing or a power imbalance. And the ADEM view sex like it's just a necessity. You have to have food, you have to have drink, you have to have sex. This is just a thing.
And I'm sure that somewhere in there, there's 1% of people who just don't care.
So that is their society. And that's where it's kind of even a thing that can be entertained because there isn't a scenario where either of them is being coerced or could have the appearance of being coerced. Because that's the other thing. Like, if there is a power imbalance, even if both parties are fully consensual, if there is the appearance of preferential treatment or favors being given out because of that, it can be a real problem.
So one thing to note, though, at the end of everything, Quoth isn't sure if this is normal within ADEM society. He isn't sure if what they did was something that is completely normal, or if there might be a power imbalance, if he was given preferential treatment, if there's something about a trade or a power dynamic or something unusual about a teacher and a student having that kind of dynamic. He's not sure, but he's going to follow Vachette's lead.
What I would suggest also in this, the ADEM are pretty damn near close to a perfect meritocracy in terms of how they view things. Like, you test yourself against the best, and that's how you prove yourself. So Quoth's reputation in all of this will be determined based on how well he is able to perform the tasks that will ultimately be set up to test him. His ability to do the K-10, his ability to understand the Lathani. And up to this point, there has been no indication that Vachette has ever gone easy on him.
No. Even after this point, there is no indication that Vachette will go easy on him.
So any things that he learns will be because he learned them, not because Vachette is doing him a favor or putting her thumb on the scale, so to speak.
She doesn't have any special fondness for him simply because they are having sex.
I think whatever fondness she has for Quoth is because she actually enjoys his company. She enjoys teaching him.
And this is a little odd for me to say because I really don't understand how you could have a sexual relationship with someone you don't like, but apparently you can. She clearly doesn't dislike him, but she doesn't have a romantic or loving feeling towards him.
Yeah, I kind of suspect that if she didn't see him as someone who had anything to offer her, I don't think that she would have offered to have sex with him.
And something to offer could even just be good conversation.
Exactly. Like, if she didn't enjoy his company, if she found him unpleasant, if she found him to be rude or mean-spirited or just kind of abrasive, I don't think she would have made the offer that she did.
Right. But I also don't think that she finds him especially attractive in any of the ways that I laid out.
She's not going to say, oh, he's my one true love or I love him or anything like that.
She's not flirtatious or coy. And that, I think, throws Quoth for a loop. And I think that that's because societally, even in like our society and a Turin society, it is expected that sexual encounters also, unless being paid for, come with the trappings of romantic encounters.
Typically, yeah.
Like, I'm going to be real here. Like, I have no idea how people go from I just met you to wanting to
fork
each other. I don't get that part because Like, I'm a little bit touch averse for some of my processing disorders and some of my parts of my weirdsies, for lack of better terms. And I would love to have more people to cuddle with. I would love to platonically cuddle with, like, all of my friends. And I can't figure out a way to sidle up to someone who I have known for, like, half my freaking life and just cuddle up and watch Ghibli movies together. I can't figure it out. You are the only person that I get to cuddle with. And I can't figure out how someone would go from, like, hey, I just met you, let's go to a hotel and you know, fork each other silly. Like, I don't get it. I am insanely awkward about the idea of even, like, hugging some of my friends. So, whole concept, completely weird to me.
But yeah, I think fundamentally, Kvothe isn't going to get special treatment from Vachette. And even the concept of getting special treatment in this sort of thing just simply isn't really a thing. That said, we live in the real world, so if you have a crush on your sexy martial arts teacher, don't do it. You keep that locked down.
Put a book in front of it. Anyway, there is a reference there. It's really old, and I don't know if anyone gets it, but I don't care. Anyway, but back to Kvothe's attitude of not being sure if this is okay or not. He goes through a kind of a list. It's like, well, there's no nudity taboo here. They don't care. I was embarrassed stumbling across people who were in the midst of a tryst, but I don't know if they were.
Well, and he notes that their response was really more startled and not scared.
Or not grabbing for a blanket to cover their nudity or something.
It's just like, oh, didn't see you there. Oh, well.
It would have been funnier if they had been like, want to join? But we won't really get to see how this particular taboo plays out or resolves for Kvothe yet in this episode right now. But we are going to move on to a different type of taboo.
Yeah. So let's talk a little bit about chapter 117, Barbarian Cunning. So in this one, we finally meet Kvothe's new sparring partner. It's a little kid.
It's a little girl. And there is something to be said here. Until puberty hormones come and kick in, literally the differences are societal and not physical in terms of muscle mass, strength, whatever. They're training, you know, little kids here get training and not like pushed past their physical limits or anything, but like get training in how to form the Catan, get training in the Lithani, get this is building blocks for when you get older. It's like it would have been way easier for me to ever roller skate if I had learned as a child. I didn't. I tried as an adult. Didn't work out. Things that are easier to learn, like guitar, would have been way easier had I stuck with it as a kid. It would have come quicker and more naturally. But learning as an adult, it's taken a long time for me to get to where I am.
The whole thing reminds me of like the worst scenario as an adult is to get into a fight with a child. Like, there is no winning.
In this particular instance, even though Kvothe is ostensibly still, to our eyes, a child, he's not, because of society, and he's not the same thing.
Like, if we were to see a 16-year-old fighting a 10-year-old, we would still say there is no winning for the 16-year-old.
That's true. The other thing, though, is that societally, because Kvothe is what we could consider a college student, it's even worse.
Yeah. Like, if you, quote, win the fight, you beat a kid. What the fork is wrong with you? And if you lose, you got beat up by a child. Like, there is no winning this.
I do appreciate that in this story, Kvothe gets beaten up by a child. I don't love that even after realizing that this society, I don't want to say prizes women, that's wrong, but almost elevates the skills and cunning and all of that stuff. If you are a girl in this society, you actually get a upper hand in all of the Catan academia, all of the school stuff, all of it, because they view boys as being boorish and hard to train. And so when you have that primed in your head that women are just going to be better at this. Women are going to be better at this. because you are going to treat them like they are better at this.
Yeah, there's a lot of self-fulfilling prophecies that go there when you expect certain behaviors and successes from certain groups, certain demographics. People in those demographics have a way of meeting those expectations for good or ill.
And just to kind of put a capper on what I said earlier, does not feel at all like there are any trans people at all in the story here. I don't think that that's actually kind of why when you go back to the narrow road between desires and there are non-binary people and or trans people listed in the tiny town that is Noir, it feels unrealistic to have the demographic all of a sudden have that many trans people represented. It's just, it's weird. I digress. But that's why when I was like talking about women and girls and whatnot, like in the first two books, it's very, very cishet normative. It just is. And so, especially when you've got different societies that we're looking at with patriarchy lenses and matriarchy lenses and all these ideals, right now, the ADEM society very much is like, oh, look, you are what we call a girl. You are better at this. It just, that's how it's portrayed.
So one of the other things that I note here is like Kvothe has this idea that girls don't fight, which is really weird because I actually took note of a few things with that, right? Like
we're going to be jumping around a little bit, but this is.
Yeah. So, I mean, first of all, this is ignoring the full-on existence of Hespa, who he spent weeks in the forest fighting bandits with.
Thank you.
So we've got that. We also know that before that, like, Davy didn't become the most feared Gaelid in Emre by being just domestic. She knew her way around a fight, and yeah, she was probably also using some sympathy, but she clearly has no compunction about use of violence.
And she is better at it than Kvothe.
Yeah. Meanwhile, Denna always carries a knife with her and knows how to use it to protect herself. Like, women in Kvothe's society that he knows do know how to fight and have known how to fight. They just have never had to fight Kvothe.
No, actually, Davy fought Kvothe, sort of.
Yeah, true.
She just bested him in, like, 2 seconds.
That wasn't a fight. That was, that was just domination.
Lovely discussion topic right after the last chapter. Anyway, we did go further toward the end of this just because you wanted to illustrate a point, but let's just put it this way. Kvothe is excited at the beginning of this chapter to finally be able to fight someone who is at his level. And then he sees who is at his level and he goes, oh, okay, this is bad. I cannot fight this person. You're a little girl and I am not one. I'm an older man. He thinks so, societally, sure. I have strength on my side and reach, therefore I am automatically better. And then he is schooled by a 10-year-old girl, and I appreciate the crap out of that.
Like, she even shows him something that he hasn't even seen before. Like, she shows him a way of getting out of a hold that he never even understood.
And I like her response. She shows him once, and he goes, it still didn't get it. And she goes, am I supposed to give it away? No, let's fight. She is portrayed as anything but a gentle, demure, sugar and spice and everything nice.
She has no illusions that she's supposed to go easy on him or spare his ego or anything like that. Like, that doesn't even enter into the thought process for her. Like, there's this bit where Vichette says, okay, I want you to learn how to fight Kvothe because you're probably not going to be above average height ever because you have your mother's genetics. You're probably always going to be a little on the short side. So you're always going to be fighting people who are taller than you. So this is good practice.
And she does not go easy. Now, we also skipped over a few things kind of about whether or not Kvothe is welcome in the town. We kind of know that he's not. There are some people that accept him and will sell him things. And then there are places that are like, you are not welcome here, go away. And that is not examined well. I'm just going to put that out there. There is a little bit of racism going on here that is not examined at all. And I think that that is perfectly fair because ostensibly Kvothe is a white male. And I don't want every discussion to happen, even in an 1,100 page book. Although there is something to be said about being insular and against outsiders.
We know that the views of the Aedim are not monolithic.
Yay, we have individuals!
We know that there are some people within the Aedim society who view the very act of having Foth living amongst them is a really big problem.
It's an abomination.
And we've also got some people who are like, hey, the more the merrier. And, you know, you've probably got a bunch of people in between that too. So yeah, it is natural that depending on what those people's relationship with the people at the school are and the various people, we'll have different views. Like there are going to be some people who probably spend more time with Carceret and have views closer to hers. There are probably also people who spend more time with Vichette and have views closer to hers. It's just going to run the gamut and it's not always going to be 100% one way or the other.
And I appreciate that as well, that there's not just one attitude towards Quoth.
Some of it may be because of their profession. Some of it may be because of their particular personal experiences. Some of it may be with just what they've been taught.
I think we have discussed this chapter in medias res forward and then all the way to the beginning of it.
Yes.
Before we're done, I think we're pretty much at exhausting this particular chapter, but I do want to say it disappoints the hell out of me at the end where Quoth can't think of anything other than telling this 10-year-old impressionable girl about his women friends. He thought of the people that he knew. Sorry. He thought of the women that he knew. Mola, Fella, Devi. Let's think about this. Denna, Ari. Did I just exhaust all the women? Also, Hespa. Like, excuse me, but did we also literally exhaust all women in that 7 people at most? You know, if we want to go back to like Maelowyn, I'm pretty sure that Maelowyn knows how to fight.
Yeah, like
with words and with swords. I'm pretty sure she does. Anyway, but it is so disappointing that the only way that he can describe what they do is that they make pictures out of stones, they buy and sell money, they write in books. What?
Yeah.
They heal the sick and mend wounds. And then they play games and plant wheat and make bread. Wow. Quoth, how reductive.
Yeah. I can guarantee you, Mola also probably knows how to seriously injure someone if she wants to.
Absolutely.
Probably kill them if she wants to.
Oh, yeah. That is super within her skill set.
We know that Fella knows the name of Iron. That means that she could probably take on an entire army if she needed to or wanted to.
Depends on what they're wearing, but yeah.
I mean, they're almost certainly going to be armed with steel weapons. She can hold her own. She has vast power that she can use if she so desires.
Right. I think Quoth is oblivious in all things.
Yes. I 100% agree with that. Which is a perfect segue to talk about our Phronemos of the Week.
Because it's never Quoth.
So who is our Aristotelian model of practical wisdom today?
Vichette. It could have been Cillian. Cillian?
I think it's Cillian.
Cillian. We're going to go with Cillian, the little 10-year-old. But Vichette wins for model of practical wisdom. She is unabashedly frank with her sexuality. She looks at Quoth and doesn't try to embarrass him for being aroused, for being physically, like, visibly aroused. She's just like, okay, you're not going to be able to think straight. Let's take care of this somehow. Do you want a partner? Do you not want a partner? I think that having a frank and not coy and not, like, obfuscating and not, like, guess what I'm thinking attitude towards everything is great. She has consented. She has made sure that he has consented. There isn't that ookiness because there's no hiding what they're both thinking, feeling, wanting. And there's also no expectation of ties, romantic or otherwise. There's no obligation to one another. And in this, there is some wisdom when all that's required is a mechanical function, but it's not just mechanically done. It's, okay, we had fun. I put as much stock in this physical activity as I put in trying to cut each other with swords. You know, there is the same amount of okay, I've taught you something that happens. And there's kind of the same attitude in both ways. Also, the next chapter, she doesn't give a crap about his pride. She's not choosing Celine as his sparring partner because she thinks it will cut him down a peg, or that she thinks that it will make him embarrassed or humiliated or whatnot. She is choosing this girl as his opponent because they match skill.
They will both have something to learn from this fight.
Yes. And so she is choosing logically and without malice or without any attempt to make anyone feel bad. But she's also looking at them. It's like, don't hurt each other. That's not what this is about. Take care of one another, but spar. Go do. And then she trusts them to do what she said.
I mean, she's certainly probably keeping an eye on things just to make sure everything's okay. But she's not watching over them like a hawk or anything. And the impression I get when Foth is described physically is that he's, if not average, maybe slightly below average in overall size.
I get the impression that he's wiry rather than strong.
So like, he's almost always going to be fighting people who are bigger than him. And that's similar to the challenges that Celaean is going to be facing. So the techniques that Celaean is using on Kvothe are going to be things that he's going to have to learn as well, because he's probably not going to be fighting people his size or smaller.
Because to be smaller is to be a child.
Right.
But also, Vichette is teaching Kvothe to not pull his punches against someone who is smaller. Because the fact that she is smaller does not mean she is less fierce.
Right.
In fact, she has no compunction whatsoever about like kicking him in the groin.
She'll fight dirty. Well, let me scratch that. Let me rephrase that. Because that implies that there is a clean way to fight and there is a dirty way to fight, as if those are two different things. As far as she is concerned, there is just fighting.
Fair.
Like, that's about the extent of it. There is fighting and not fighting.
There is fighting with advantage, or there is fighting where you don't use your advantages to your advantage.
Well, and in Kvothe's case, he can't help the fact that he is taller. He has longer legs and arms than Celaean does. As a fighter, he would be a fool not to use those to his advantage.
And you know what he didn't do?
Use those to his advantage.
Right, because she's a little girl and he just decided that because she's a little girl, he can't possibly fight her like a real person.
And she quickly disabuses him of that notion.
Exactly. And I love that. Anyway, now that that has gotten out of our system, it is your turn to talk about a recommended thing.
So my thing of the week is going to be the new Dune movies.
Ah, both of them? Or
both of them.
Okay. Because one of those qualifies as new, and the other one qualifies as it's 3 years old, dude.
Look, the 90s were only a few years ago. Yeah, so we just watched Dune Part 2 yesterday, in fact, as of this recording. And, you know, we had a really good time. I'm going to recommend both of the movies together. We watched Dune Part 1 Friday night, and then yesterday, which was our Saturday, we went and saw Part 2. They're really good movies.
Now, clearly, you cannot watch Part 2 and not have seen Part 1 and expect to understand any of it. So yes, you do have a 6-hour-ish time ahead of you all about Dune. However, that is shorter than reading it or listening to the audiobook.
Yeah, and you know, I'm just going to say this. I think it would be kind of silly to see Part 2 without seeing Part 1. So I'd say just see them both. Honestly, make a double feature of it. I will say that seeing Dune on the big screen and not as it was intended to be seen, which is at home being interrupted by your cat, is a different experience altogether.
That being said, I do have a question. I know Part 1 we saw initially on our television. It was through HBO Max or something like that. That's how we watched the first movie. That's the only way we've watched the first movie. I don't remember, because it was at the height of the we're not going to movie theaters part of the pandemic. I don't remember if it came out in theaters, but I assume it did.
It did not.
It didn't.
No, it was all directly to HBO Max.
Really?
Yeah.
Are they going to release it? Have they released it to theaters to be able to watch without it being at risk of being interrupted by your cat's butt? Because that's what happened to us multiple times. Every time we've watched this movie, we have had to tell the cat not to take the TV down.
Yeah. as the filmmakers intended.
Right. That's a different type of sandworm.
Yeah. No, I think it did get a limited release in theaters a few months back, like just for like a weekend.
That's sad because I think that it probably was a better viewing experience, all kidding aside, in theaters than it would be no matter how big your TV is.
Or how well-behaved your cat is.
It seems like that movie is one of those movies that's meant for the big screen, kind of like Mad Max Fury Road was. It's still a good movie if you watch it at home, but oh my goodness, was it just a really good in-theater experience. And I would say the same thing about Dune Part 2 is that I appreciated it being in a theater when we saw it. Like, the spectacle really wasn't there. The shared camaraderie, even though it's much smaller audiences than maybe things used to be, it's still nice to have a shared experience with strangers seeing a movie and all, like, finding the same things kind of chuckle-worthy or finding the same things shocking.
I think also part of it is that when I'm watching a movie at home, the temptation to pull out my phone and dink around on whatever is a lot stronger. Whereas when I'm in a theater, my phone is put away the entire time.
That's very much true. Now, for full disclosure, we have seen a few movies in movie theaters in the last year, and we have been wearing masks because there is a whole bunch of crud still going around, and I still don't feel comfortable being in a enclosed space with people who I don't know what they're breathing out. But honestly, it's like, it's not that bad to wear a mask at the movie theater. No. It really isn't. And for certain things, I'll go. Like, we saw Guardians of the Galaxy, and we've even seen like the Marvels, which I think we were the only people, or maybe there was like a couple other people there.
Godzilla Minus One.
Yes.
Boy and the Heron.
Yes. So we have seen things. We've chosen times where it's not as busy, and we've also chosen to wear masks. But, you know, limited exposure. Honestly, if I had the stamina to sit there for as long, might have wanted to go see Dune Part 1 in a theater with you before seeing Part 2. But we did watch it on streaming, and super worth it.
Yeah. I'd say that Part 2 is where we start to see an interrogation of sort of the Campbellian hero's journey type narrative.
I think they could have gone harder, personally.
I think one of the things that you see pretty much throughout it is that, like, once Paul basically says, yeah, I'm going to really embrace destiny or whatever.
Spoilers.
I mean, I'm spoiling a 50-year-old book.
It's more than that. It's 60 years old, dude.
Yeah, you're right.
Anyway, go on.
You know, as he embraces his destiny, we see he's come to grips with the fact that, no, he's not going to bring back gifts to the family or the people or anything like that, share the gift with the world. No, he actually just unleashes horror and bloodshed.
I felt like we got left in a morally gray area and not in a truly tipped the scales into bad area. That's where I'm going to leave my review. I think it could have gone a little bit harder, but I don't dislike where it ended up. I do like some of the changes that were made narratively so that it didn't come off as goofy, which I think has happened in previous adaptations.
Are you talking about David Lynch's Dune?
Maybe.
I mean, look, I will say that Austin Butler as Phaedra Otha is no Sting, but
nobody is.
Nobody is. He does not even wear the weird V-shaped Speedo.
I think the movie's better for that.
Probably.
He was quite honestly, like, really, really did this role very, very well, in my opinion. I have come up with a couple of instances of really recently finding the best performances out of the, quote, evil characters in things. Last Airbender. Not to say that any of the other performances in Dune Part 2 were bad, because they weren't. They were all quite good. But I think that that was probably the most affecting performance.
And you also have to have Stellan Skarsgård in the mix as well for those conversations.
True.
He's just damn good in just about everything he's in.
He is very menacing.
Yeah.
Anyway, I agree. I don't want to give too much away in case you haven't read the book or in case you are unfamiliar with this much older than us story. But yes, definitely recommended on my part as well.
All right. So with that out of the way, let's go ahead and get to words from life and words from the books. So your 7 words are from the books. What'd you pick?
Talking about Celian, my 7 words are kind of a tie between 2 sentences that are back to back, but I'm going to go with she was no sort of delicate flower, followed right after she was quick and fearless and aggressive.
Good picks.
You know, those are definitely my favorite parts of this couple of chapters. You know, there's some other bits that are not terrible. You know, at last a chance to prove myself. Vachette seemed to enjoy herself as well, which I think is good to point out, even if he is kind of being a little full of himself by saying, like, I had a good time and I think she did too. I think he's being a little more realistic. It's like, I don't think she'd have kept doing it if she didn't. So I think she did. There is actually an easy way to find out. He could have asked. I will say also, he was too worried about ruining a good thing to ask her if this was okay and normal. And it could have saved him a lot of heartache and a lot of questioning and a lot of confusion. There's also, I can't describe this delicately, I suppose. I tried to hide my obvious arousal. Kind of made me laugh. And also, this one takes the cake for being, like, on the nose. This is embarrassing to look back on. I think that all of those are fair, but I really like pointing out how fearless and fierce this little 10-year-old girl is. And the utter takedown of our hero character. Which I think this little section actually proves that all of the Mary Sue, Marty Stew, whatever the heck, it wasn't intended to be that way. It was intended to be, hey, he starts out not being the best and gets to learn how to be the best through a bunch of different teachers, including women.
And I think this is maybe challenging some of the Marty Stew views that Foth had of himself.
I'm just good at everything.
Right. Anyway, moving on, I have 7 words from life, and this is an old one. This goes back several years ago. We were attending a minor league hockey game with our friends, and then we were hanging out, and they started playing the good old hockey game, which is the best game you can name. And I'll never forget, he just got this faraway look in his eyes, and he just said, "They play the songs of my people." He's from Michigan, so where there are more minor league hockey teams per capita than anywhere else in the U.S.
I have fond memories of that day, yeah.
And I just couldn't help but think of that. I don't know why. It made me laugh.
I like it. It's cute. It's a fun little anecdote. Minor league hockey is a fun thing to go watch.
Yeah. Minor league sports in general.
They don't take themselves so seriously, but they are really good and really fun to watch and really great to take people that you're friends with and that even if they don't necessarily enjoy that particular sport, it's fun to root for and it's fun to engage in and it's not so self-serious that you can't just kick back.
It's a good time.
Especially hockey.
All right. And so with that, I'd like to thank you for potting with me.
Thank you for potting with me.
And thanks for listening to Tales from the Waystone. Join us next time on Tales from the Waystone as we discuss chapters 118 and 119 of The Wise Man's Fear through the lens of questioning purpose.
We would like to thank our friend Shawnee Jank for our theme music.
And many thanks to Patrick Rothfuss for creating this world that we've enjoyed exploring.
Audio production, editing, and social media coordination, courtesy of me, Phoenix McCullough.
And writing and project management, courtesy of me, Will McCullough.
If you would like to help support us and have the means to do so and would like to hear us chat about things like The Sandman or maybe get some art from me or some other stuff, we do have a Patreon. If any of that sounds good, patreon.com/waystonepod. Also, just to resolve stuff, Will's job is currently secured. We are not in any hardship or financial need or any of that stuff. Don't sign up for Patreon just to try to like help with that. That's not necessary. Mostly, we want to make sure that you get some value out of what you sub for and that we get to make fun, awesome, cool things. And that's really our purpose.
And of course, you can always join us on our Discord server. There'll be a link in the description.
And that is free and available. And we are on it a decent amount and we post a lot of memes. And that's really what we do there.
But if you want to chat, we're more than happy to have a conversation.
Absolutely. Just
poke us.
Poke us or be patient because sometimes it'll take a day or two.
And with that, here's to one more day above the roses.
To one more day above the roses.
Ding! Ding.
Just to... Dog!